This is a commercial-free archive edition of our live radio show that airs every Friday at noon Arizona time on OpenMinds.tv.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host, Alejandra Rojas, former official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network. Alejandro has been a UFO paranormal researcher and journalist for nearly a decade and has logged hours in the field investigating the paranormal up close and personal. And now Open Minds Radio presents evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome to Open Minds Radio, where we are bringing the UFO subject into the light of day. This is Alejandro Rojas. And we have another great show. We're back from Mexico, including our news correspondent, Jason McClelland. We'll talk about that in just a minute. And our guest was one of the speakers out there, Donald Schmidt. He's an incredible guy. He's been investigating UFOs for decades. He was a co-director for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. You probably remember me referring to J. Allen Hynek many times. He worked for the Air Force as a UFO researcher. He was also a special investigator for the Hynek and the art director for the International UFO Reporter. He's done a lot more than that, actually, as well. Since then, he has been on the Discovery Channel several times with a Roswell Diggs special. We've talked to other people who have been on that show about that a bit. But this guy is a Roswell, probably the guy to interview when it comes to Roswell. He's got all the details, knows all the people, and he's going to share with us why this alleged crash of a UFO in Roswell was the real deal and was not a weather balloon. So I'm really excited to have Don on the show. We'll start off with the basics with Don because he's got so much information in this, but he'll definitely be someone that we'll have on the show in the future. Speaking of Mexico, many of you have gotten our first issue of the magazine. And one of the things we did out in Mexico was get some great pictures for the second issue. We've got a great story on the Aztecs and some of their omens that Antonio had written. We talked a bit about that last week. And so we were able to visit Teotihuacan, some of those giant pyramids they have out there. And that was a lot of fun. And we were out there for Jaime Musan's conference. We were able to stream it, so it looked like many of you went to the website to see that, and you're able to watch the guests live there. We've also got them recorded, so eventually we'll get them up on our website so you can see them there as well, because even though the English, about half of them weren't English speakers, the cool thing was that they were translated real-time into English. And some of the non-English presentations were incredible, especially the groups of pilots that they had and their sightings that they shared, and the researchers that they have out there with all of the UFO sightings that they've gotten, because there are a lot of UFO sightings out there. One of the guys who gets these sightings all the time is a guy named Antonio Urzi. And, you know, I got to say, we were out there filming what might be UFOs. We got to look at it closer, but we're definitely seeing things in the sky. So we'll talk to Jason about Mexico. But first, let's bring Jason on to do some UFOs in the news.
Good afternoon, Alejandro. Hello, Phoenix, and hello, world. This is your Open Mind News Brief for Friday, March 26, 2010. An update to a story we've been covering, the mysterious lights that were appearing over Lake Erie have been identified as lights from incoming jets, according to Tom Wertman, a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network. The lights were observed, recorded, and reported by Ohio resident Eugene Ehrlich for more than nine consecutive nights, and the sighting received extensive press coverage from Fox News and MSNBC. But even though that's the final word from MUFON, it's still really unsure what the lights actually were. Because the lights appeared over Lake Erie and at night, same place, same every time, every night.
Well, I know when I used to fly to Pennsylvania, we used to fly over Lake Erie from Chicago, and when you make a turn over the lake like we did, we would look like a light getting really bright and fading out.
Right.
So those are the kind of things we got a lot in Denver around the airport, people mistaking UFOs for planes.
Absolutely, and that's usually a sign, you know, if lights are appearing repeatedly, same time, every night.
So we'll see.
Right. In other news, last week, German scientists announced that they have created a three-dimensional invisibility cloak. Photonic crystals and special lenses create a cloak by partially bending light waves. The findings are published in the journal Science.
Crazy. I mean, the technology is getting pretty amazing, but I think what that cloak was, too, is just like tiny little microbes or tiny little specks of gold.
Right, right. But it's a cool thing to think about. You know, that's something that everybody's thought about, you know, the possibility of being invisible.
Yep.
And while it's a cool thought, it's also a scary thought, thinking about the applications for it.
Yep. The first step is a little piece of gold. The next step is a Klingon warship.
I always enjoyed their cloaking devices. Also in the news, on Monday morning, Virgin Galactic's Spaceship 2 completed its first captive flight, reaching an altitude of 45,000 feet. The three-hour flight was a success and another major step towards commercial space flights. There have been no announcements regarding a date when space tourism flights might begin, but Virgin Galactic has already received $45 million in deposits for space flights from more than 330 people.
I hope they pull it off. What happens if they don't? They got to refund all that?
Yeah, right. Eek. I think it's really exciting. I mean, the thought of going into space and space tourism, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And we'll get there eventually, but even when it starts, even if it starts next year, I'm certainly not getting in line because these people are paying astronomical amounts to go into space. Just, you know, wait 20 years. It'll be cheap.
And I guess it does include, like, at least an overnight or two-day stay at the spaceport.
I think so, and they go through training, and, I mean, I'm sure it'll be fun, but I wouldn't spend the cash on it right now.
Yeah.
But we'll see. They're making huge progress. It's really exciting to see. And in Open Minds news, Open Minds has officially launched Open Minds magazine. We've been accepting orders for the magazine on the Open Minds website for a couple of weeks, but the first shipment went out last week, and magazines have begun arriving in mailboxes around the world. Additionally, this week the magazine began appearing on the shelves of Barnes & Noble, Borders, and other bookstores around the United States.
Yeah, it's really exciting. People loved it. We took a bunch out there for the speakers out there. In Mexico, they all loved it, and they were all saying, hey, we want to write for it, we want to write for it, which we love. You know, anybody out there who feels you're good at writing, you could go to our website and submit a story idea. You know, we try to stick to more of a news reporting, not opinion. You know, it's more of presenting the facts, like you'll see in our magazine. But go to the local Barnes & Noble and pick yours up. And you'll be able, I think you'll be really impressed.
The response to this magazine has been phenomenal. It's a really good magazine.
Yep. So. I haven't heard from anybody saying that. It's awful, and I have some friends out there who can be very blunt.
I'm sure they'll come, but it is a quality magazine, and I'm proud to be a part of it. But that's it for the news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan. Back to you, Alejandro.
All right, great. So, yeah, this magazine, of course, we are very excited about. Like I said, it's in your local Barnes & Noble, so go there and check it out. If they ran out, then go to the next one. And if they ran out, or at each place, tell them, hey, man, where's the magazine? You should order more. So that way they will. Because it's an awesome magazine. A lot of work went into it, and the graphic designs are just incredible. We have a great graphic design group that did a great job with it. So not only is the content great, but it looks beautiful as well. Some of you have probably seen some of it on the website. So go check that out. Coming up next, we will be talking about Roswell. We'll be talking about Alan J. Hynek. We'll be talking about old UFO stuff, new, latest breaking UFO witnesses who have come forward, and why Roswell was a real deal, and this guy's evidence is pretty dang convincing. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Open Minds Radio on KFNX.
You're listening to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
All right, welcome back. I want to remind you, too, that all of those news stories that Jason talked about earlier in the show can also be seen on the front page of our website, openminds.tv, and we update that on a nearly daily basis. I was a little out of sorts this week here and there, so it was slower. It wasn't updated as quickly as usual, but it has been updated, and there's a very interesting story about UFO wave that happened in 1954 where the mayor tried to ban these things, and this whole incident inspired a whine. So kind of a neat story. But now we have our special guest, Don Schmidt. Are you on the line?
Alejandro, yes.
Hello, it's great to hear from you.
Good to talk to you again.
Yeah.
So you didn't fare so well after the last trip, but...
Unfortunately, this one got me.
That last burrito you had, I know.
I think I got it on the plane, you know, and it just seems wise to wear a respirator when you're traveling internationally on a plane.
I hear that more and more, and I'm surprised that more of us don't take ill,
yeah,
considering everyone we're in contact with. But I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, that was nothing I want to go through again. Well, it's good to talk to you again. It was a lot of fun to hang out with you for a little while out there in Mexico City.
It was, yeah. I enjoyed it as well.
Uh-huh. And as far as you know, one of the things, the main subject I believe you talked about out there was Roswell. And do you get the feeling that Mexico is as up to speed on the whole Roswell legend as we are out here?
Well, when you consider that it isn't, you know, that far, I'm actually here up in Wisconsin, further from Roswell than, most of Mexico.
Right.
I think that, and especially going back even to that time in 1947, there were a good number of people of Hispanic persuasion who were even involved.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of Hispanic stationed at the base at Roswell at that time, and even a lot of the ranch hands, civilians who were involved. Even the famous Dr. Lincoln La Paz, the famous meteor expert up at the University of Albuquerque, New Mexico in Albuquerque, would come in later that fall, assigned from Washington, to go out into the field and actually determine the speed and trajectory of this crashed object. Well, I find it amusing that why would anybody be concerned about determining speed and trajectory of a weather balloon?
Right.
As
now,
remains
this,
the official explanation.
Was this the professor who he believed at first that it was something, technology, and then he changed his story later?
No, in fact, he never changed his story.
Okay.
In fact, one of the counterintelligence non-commissioned officers, Sergeant Lewis Rickett, was assigned to assist him in the field for 3 weeks. And La Paz, because of his meteor exploration, he believed in the technique of triangulation. And in that fashion, that manner, by interviewing enough witnesses, you would triangulate. And then you would be able to determine precisely where something impacted, where it came down. And that's precisely what he did regarding the Roswell crash. He spoke to enough of the ranchers and surrounding people, and that's how he made his judgments as far as how fast, at what angle, and precisely what trajectory this came in. And according to Rickett, who I had interviewed quite a few times before he died, he did not see the final report that La Paz sent to Washington, but La Paz told him he was convinced it was interplanetary.
Wow.
And that was the word they used back then. We had no knowledge of our solar system as we did within the next 15 years thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 1947, that was the word. It wasn't extraterrestrial. It was interplanetary. Nonetheless, it was still something off this planet.
Right. So by now, how many witnesses have you spoke to, witnesses that you believe are legitimate?
We have to date spoken to over 600
Wow.
people, either first, second, or third hand involved, and that's over the last 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we only intensify our search for these people, and as you've heard me say, Alejandro, we're racing with the Undertaker.
Right.
The World War II generation, attrition rate is only intensifying each day. We're losing at the rate of 1,500 every 24 hours.
Wow.
And sadly, so many of these people take all of their secrets with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we afford them that one last opportunity to finally, go on the record and tell the truth. Tell the truth for their families. Tell the truth for their fellow countrymen, their very country itself. I think we all deserve to know what actually happened.
And you've had some success there with some deathbed confessions.
We are now approaching 20 deathbed confessions. And invariably, they all talk about the little men, the little people.
Wow.
That seems to be the big secret in all this, the fact that there were bodies involved. It wasn't anything that was unmanned in that regard. It was it actually had a crew. And as a result, they've had to live with something that has haunted them, something one of the he's still alive. He lives in Albuquerque. And he was one of the MPs that was part of the unit that actually took the bodies from Building 84, P3 as it was called back in 1947. It was a large B-29 hangar. And they escorted the bodies over to the base hospital. And they were draped as far as with sheets. And as they pushed the gurneys, someone stepped on the corner of one of the coverings, and it pulled free from the body. And this particular MP, he saw the eyes open, and it turned its head and looked at him.
Wow.
So in other words, one was alive, one survived. Well, even according to his wife, they have not slept in the same bedroom for over now 30 years because he still has the nightmares, the flashbacks. He will bolt up in the middle of the night and scream out because he can't get that face out of his mind.
Wow.
So, and then these people, they get emotional. They talk and the tears flow as they talk about this. So it's something that has left this, an indelible mark on their very psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And after now 63 years, They care. As one of the witnesses said to us, it's the first thing he thinks of in the morning when he gets up and the last thing when he goes to bed.
Well, what got you involved with Roswell research? Now, you had been researching UFOs for quite some time. Why did you decide to particularly focus on Roswell?
Well, I had been a special investigator with Dr. J. Allen Hynek right up to the time of his death. And then immediately following that, I was appointed his director of special investigations. And the one case that everybody was still talking about was Roswell. Were crash saucer retrieval cases even possible? And I was quite the skeptic. In fact, even dating back to 1985, I had even done a paper with the Center for UFO Studies that I just didn't feel it was conceivable that a story of that magnitude could be kept secret for all that time. And we were planning a trip to the Southwest in the fall of 88, and I had just been to a lecture with Stanton Friedman. And I approached him backstage before the program, and I asked him point blank, did he feel that they had interviewed every last possible witness, if he felt that there were others still available, still out there. And I was actually quite surprised for him to say, Don, there are probably hundreds of people still out there that have, yet to be discovered.
Right.
And I took that pretty much as a green light. And he did encourage us to, go right ahead, see what you can do as far as even an independent investigation on your own. And we made that first trip within a few months. It was February of 1989. Again, very confident we would wrap this up in a weekend. And we came away, especially after speaking to first-hand witness who actually handled the wreckage, the material.
Mm-hmm.
And as they described it, the characteristics that defied all conventional explanation, even up to 2010 now as I look back. And we left with the mission, we have to get back here as soon as possible.
Can you tell us who that witness was?
What was that?
Could you tell us who that person was?
Oh, well, that was even the rancher's son, Mac Brazel Jr., Bill Brazel Jr.
The son of the rancher who founded him.
That's correct. And then his wife, Shirley, was there at the same time. And we spent an entire afternoon And even when we always came back, could it have been a weather balloon? Could it have been a plane, a rocket? And he just fired right back, you know, no, I have never seen anything like this in my entire life. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, incredible by now. And a lot of these witnesses, I'm sure, are also military.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that we typically are getting the deathbeds from. They lived their lives sworn to secrecy. They took oaths back in 1947, never to say another word about this. And sadly, they wait until their very deathbeds before they finally feel that the government can't hurt me any longer. They can't take my pension away from me. Mm-hmm. And I need to tell, you know, my closest members of my family what actually happened. I have to, it's like Superman finally admitting, Clark Kent, you know, I'm Superman.
Right. So I want to talk about some of those witnesses when we get back from our break. We got to take a short break right now. We're talking with Donald Schmidt, who's a Roswell researcher, among many other things. We'll talk more about his history. You're listening to Open Minds Radio on KFNX.
This is Open Minds Radio. Here again, your host, UFO paranormal researcher and journalist, Alejandro Rojas.
Welcome back to Open Minds Radio. We're talking to Don Schmidt, longtime UFO researcher, and recently heralded, right before we left the conference, by one of our colleagues as one of the most attractive men in UFO research. I wanted to congratulate you on that one.
I sense a tone of jealousy there, Alejandro.
Yeah, you guys. One day I'll get there. Do something new with my hair or something. I grew this little goatee type thing to make that happen, but that's okay. I'll keep trying.
We all do. We have to work at it every day.
So I want to go way back before we get into the deathbed confessions real quick, and I want to find out about your entrance into UFO investigation at all, what you were doing at that time, and why you got inspired to work so hard on this subject.
You're talking specifically Roswell or UFOs?
No, now UFOs in general.
I had an interest through even elementary school, and I, through high school, at the peak of even the Air Force involvement with Project Blue Book. And there wasn't a week that went by that UFOs weren't in the public arena. I mean, the constant jousting between the investigators and even the press and the Air Force as to what was actually happening. It was an exciting time to observe because any time we were left with the impression that something was going to break, something was going to happen, the government was finally going to come clean. Well, as we both know historically, that since 1969, everything has gone under the table, everything's gone underground. The level of official denial is such that I think more and more of us are starting to believe that if we don't solve it, if we don't, you know, breach that cloak of silence, then nobody will.
Yeah, I know, you know, that happens ever since I've been in this field, only, you know, about a decade. Seriously, you always have this disclosure is going to happen any minute. Disclosure is going to happen any minute. Any slight little movement in by any politician or in Washington, and people think, oh, it's just around the corner. But in the 40s and 50s, you had a lot of military openly investigating UFO subject.
And through the 60s, right up until 1970.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the good fortune of being to Socorro, New Mexico, which was the famous landing that took place in April of 1964 involving the late Lonnie Zamora, who just died last year. And that was the one case that really threw the Air Force. My scientific director, Dr. Hynek, admitted to us years later that they finally had to accept that they were dealing with nuts and bolts, that something had actually landed. In fact, even in the Air Force report, it refers to the vehicle. So we weren't talking about mass hallucination or weather anomaly or anything astronomical.
Swamp,
clearly
yes.
Something had touched down.
Yeah, I mean, I had read also that Hector Quintanilla eventually admitted that that case for him was one that he admits was mysterious, even though he really didn't believe that UFOs were a threat or anything. But he did say that, you know, that was one unresolved case.
That's correct, and he was the last director of Blue Book. And I think the pressure was growing to the point that even the mass media had enough of swamp gas and lights in the sky explanations. They realized that the government had to either throw up their hands, that they were helpless, that there was something that was flying through our airspace with total impunity and they couldn't do anything about it, or they actually had evidence, they had answers, as we now are convinced they have in regards to crash retrievals, that they actually have physical proof that we're being visited, that it is something manufactured off the planet.
Mm-hmm. Now, during like that period of time that we're talking about, 40s, 50s, and 60s, you had people like Gerald Ford as a senator calling for...
He was a congressman in Michigan at
congressman,
that time, right.
Sorry. But, yeah, he was asking for, you know, the government to look into these subjects. You had the first director of the CIA, Hillenkoetter, who was...
Roscoe Hillenkoetter, correct.
At least a couple quotes in what the Washington Post about how he felt the Air Force was hiding information.
In fact, Hillenkoetter actually belonged... I mean, you're talking about the first director of the CIA, and he eventually would become a member of one of the first civilian UFO groups, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, out of Washington, D.C. So many of these people, it's no different, and you could cite the case of the late Senator Barry Goldwater of your own state of Arizona, and his failed efforts in trying to get the chair of the Joint Chiefs, General Curtis LeMay, to open the files. He wanted to see the proof. He was convinced, again, that the government had the answers. And as Goldwater himself told us, LeMay said to him, "Hell no, and don't ever ask me again."
Right.
And then he added further, "And if you ever bring this up again, I will personally see that you're court-martialed." Now, Goldwater was a brigadier general.
Yeah.
And for LeMay to tell him that his request warranted being court-martialed, please, ladies and gentlemen, don't tell me there isn't a UFO cover-up.
Right. That's
when
heavy.
Someone who was a former presidential candidate and senator and a brigadier general is basically told, you know, this subject is off limits. Don't even bring it up.
Right. And definitely be loved out here. We've got lots of Barry Goldwater, this and that around here. So.
Well, they need to look into that. They need to realize, I mean, all of Arizona, I mean, for those who are still very fond of the memory of Barry Goldwater. I mean, look into that. I mean, this is something that Goldwater used to lament about over and over again to the press, and he could never get anybody to follow up on it.
Now, this all really kind of, some of this fervor, although looking into when Roswell happened, it looked like flying saucers were all over the news when you listen to those broadcasts, because they're of the sort of, is this, you know, finally going to be resolved? So it seems like people knew this was in the news. Do you think, even though it kind of faded away a bit, do you think behind the scenes Roswell had a lot to do with a lot of these military people coming out and taking a harder look?
Well, in fact, the very first Air Force investigation, which was Project Sign, originated due to that very wave. That last week of June, first week of July, leading up to Roswell, for explaining Roswell as a weather balloon, and then there was a conscientious effort by the Army Air Corps to put on weather balloon demonstrations all over the country at that time, which we've been able to document. So they weren't only trying to explain Roswell, they were trying to sweep all of these sightings aside. And nonetheless, it's still necessitated the creation of that very first Air Force project, Project Sign, which went on for a year, and their conclusion that went right up to the chair of the Joint Chiefs, then Colonel Hoyt Vandenberg, was that the phenomenon, again, was interplanetary.
Right.
That was their conclusion a year after Roswell. And Vandenberg ordered the report burned because he felt it didn't provide evidence. Well, Vandenberg was up to his eyeballs as far as regarding Roswell. And lest we forget the very first director of Project Blue Book, the late Captain Edward Ruppelt.
Yep.
In his own book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, he stated that by the end of July, now the very month that Roswell happened, he states that by the end of July of 1947, Air Technical Intelligence Commission was in a complete panic over the situation.
Wow, we've got to go to a break right now, but we'll finish that up and talk more about those deathbed confessions. We'll be right back. You're listening to Open Minds Radio on KFNX.
Welcome back to Open Minds Radio. Here now, former official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network, your host of Open Minds Radio, Alejandro Rojas.
All right, we are here with Donald Schmidt, one of the original investigators when it comes to Roswell and many different cases, so it's exciting to have him on the show. And I think, did you get the total quote out there? You were talking about Ruppelt's quote?
Yes.
Okay, I thought so.
Yes. Yeah, that was it. That's the basically the Pentagon. Just imagine today if the Pentagon should announce that they were in a panic over anything.
Right.
What had created that? And once again, we believe it was Roswell. The fact that they had something drop into their laps without any answers, no answers as to from where, from why, or from who.
And now let's talk about some of those deathbed confessions. I believe one of those was actually Walter Hott, who was one of the first witnesses, military witnesses, and then later he added to his claims.
Well, Walter Hott was a first lieutenant. He was with the 509th Bomb Group back in 1947. He was a public information officer. He was the liaison between the local community, the local press, and the base. And so it was his job to put out press releases issued by the base itself, by the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, and he would receive a phone call later in the morning of July 8th after a couple of truckloads, or I should say car and a jeep, load of actual debris had been returned to the base from the crash site. And they put out that, that now famous press release about the actual capture of a flying saucer on a ranch north of Roswell at that time. So he distributed that press release.
And he was ordered to do so by Colonel Blanchard, right?
By Colonel Blanchard, correct. And not only would it make worldwide news at that time, it went out over the wire services, and Walter would describe to us that he had a stack of phone calls on his desk 6 inches high, but within 5 hours, that first explanation was retracted, was recanted. And going up the chain of command, Colonel Blanchard's boss was Brigadier General Roger Ramey of the 8th Air Force over in Fort Worth at Carsville Army Airfield, and they had a press conference. And even General Ramey's chief of staff at that time, General Thomas DeBose, admitted to us before he died that they switched the real material for a weather balloon. They substituted a very common weather device with a radar reflector kite. It was laid out on the floor of General Ramey's office. The press was allowed to come in and photograph it, and that would be the end of it as far as the press and
now,
the general public were known.
I think, said that he didn't know what it was, what was replaced. He just knew they had replaced the actual material.
That's correct, yes. And, in fact, he played dumb to it. He acted, I think he tried to at least smooth out the impression that the 509th Bomb Group over at Roswell, the very squadron, which was in charge of the atomic bomb, was unable to identify, again, a very common weather device. And when I say common, I mean that the materials, you're talking about neoprene rubber for the balloon itself, and the reflector kites were nothing but wooden sticks, reflective foil, and masking tape. You know, something, you know, a five-year-old child would have been able to recognize. But Walter always stuck to that story, that he distributed that press release. He heard a few other things on the base and nothing more. But because he was so close to Colonel Blanchard, I mean, they were almost like uncle and nephew in their personal relationship, we realized that Walter had to have been brought into the loop. He had to have seen and known more, being that close to the very base commander. Mm-hmm. And I always went back to him, and through the years, he gave us little trickles of more and more information, to the point that when Walter, who was always reluctant to go on the record and admit everything that he was aware of, he finally agreed to a signed statement, a sealed statement for posthumous release, something that could come out after he was gone.
Right.
And 2 years before he died, that's precisely what he did, and admitted to not only handling the wreckage, being out at the site, but also being taken to that hangar I described earlier and seeing the bodies laid out on the floor.
Right. And this all fits. It all makes sense. I mean, one of the things I find interesting is Jesse Marcel, the guy who found the stuff.
Head of intelligence, right.
Head of intelligence at the base. He found it strange, brings it to his boss. Everybody's shocked. They send out a press release that it's a flying saucer. Then, you know, they don't get in trouble for misidentifying it. Instead, according to Marcel, they're told to shut up, and they do, like good
soldiers.
And they
do, and they're all promoted after the fact. I mean, Colonel Blanchard would go on to become a four-star general.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Marcel would retire a lieutenant colonel. Walter, sadly, who the newspaper accounts describe as having been severely reprimanded, you know, by Washington, denied he so much as ever received a scolding from anyone.
Mm.
But yet, for whatever reason, he did resign from the military a year later. I think a lot of it was because his spirit was broken.
Yeah.
That they knew what actually happened, and they were all forced to live this lie.
Mm-hmm.
Or about the biggest story of all time.
So, who are some of the other deathbed confessors that you were just ecstatic to find?
Well, another one, and it's someone I didn't mention at the summit in Mexico City, but he's. He's a civilian, but he's also a scientist, an engineer. He was a mechanical engineer at Boeing Aircraft, and he worked specifically in their crash investigation team back in 1947. His name was Richard Loveridge, and he was responsible for both Texas and New Mexico crash investigation at that time. So he had homes in both San Antonio and in Roswell, of all places.
Interesting.
And after this happened, he was immediately called in for what he thought was going to be a routine plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
But it was much more.
Right.
It was so much more that he refused to talk about it. Refused to talk about it for many years thereafter. In fact, every time his son heard anything new about Roswell, knowing that his father had actually been there, his father would just always respond, "Don't ask, don't ask, don't go there, don't talk about it."
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until he was dying in 1993 that he finally told his son what happened, and that he had actually been out at the crash site, and that he had seen the remains of the ship, which was clearly, you know, non-conventional, and saw the bodies. He admitted to seeing the bodies.
Wow.
And again, he described them as the others, that they were small, child-sized, and that they were clearly not human.
But he
warned his son, please don't ever say anything, because the government can still hurt you.
Right.
That's how he put it. And that was in 1993, before he died.
Amazing.
So that they lived, you know, with that level of intimidation and fear. Right up to the moment, and they're warning their families, you know, the very same thing. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about this.
Now, Forrest Dahl, I know at least in Paul David's movie, and I think it comes from some of your work, there's a connection between Forrest Dahl and the Bings.
Well, Forrest Dahl was the Secretary of War, which was the predecessor to the Secretary of Defense, as he was in 1947. And immediately after this whole situation, he became quite interested. In fact, if we were to go back to the White House log of meetings during that whole week that this took place, you would have thought World War III had started. I mean, there were emergency meetings as far as between Forrest Dahl and the president, Vandenberg, who I mentioned, chair of the Joint Chiefs.
Mm-hmm. Starting to run out of time.
As far as Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, and others, James Doolittle, and other generals. And again, it was as though we were, you know, under a major alert. And Forrest Dahl was one of them. And right after this, he becomes rather openly outspoken mm-hmm. about UFOs.
Wow.
And he starts to even keep a log, and he starts to even suggest areas and ways that the phenomenon needs to be investigated. And we know that he had marital problems. He also had bouts with depression. And there was concerns that he may have even been suicidal.
Right.
He was hospitalized, and he was found that he either had jumped or something else outside of his hospital bedroom.
Right.
And I know many people just dismiss it as being nothing more than a sad, tragic ending to someone who was into bouts of hallucination and depression.
Yeah.
But then there are those who suggest he was getting too close. He was looking under the
truth.
Right.
Very interesting. Thank you for being on the show, Don. That was great. I mean, it's just incredible information on Roswell out there that people do not realize. And where can I go to see some of your books?
Our website is RoswellInvestigator.com.
RoswellInvestigator.com.
One word, right.
Great.
Our current book, Witness to Roswell, is there. So,
thanks for being on the show. We'll have you again. And for the rest of you, be sure to show up next Friday. You've been listening to Open Minds Radio on KFNX.